Your work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
You may think of the typical burnout as someone who's been struggling to stay in the middle class. But burnout is an equal opportunity attacker. A number of my clients are quite successful, but felt burned out, empty, wondering whether all that effort was worth it. And at the other end of the socioeconomic continuum, many people are burned out because they've been unable to hold a job that sustains even a modest living, and their personal life is equally dispiriting. Burnout can lead to undue sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and the sense that nothing matters, or at least nothing matters enough to justify working hard to improve your career and your life. Well, what's a burnout to do? Well, it tends to be all-encompassing. So if I just focused on ways to improve your career, I think I'd be doing short shrift to the problem. So I'm going to ask you to consider, I'm going to ask you 23 questions to briefly, at least we can't spend too much time in between questions, meditating on these to see if any of them, if you or someone you care about is burned out, might be a baby step to help you move forward. I'll start with the explicitly career-related. Number one, is it as simple as you need to simply change your boss? Or do you simply need to change your place of employment? Do you need to change your field? Do you need to improve your skill set, whether it's hard skills or soft, like soft skills like listening skills? Everybody thinks they're a good listener, but most people are not. Your management of your time, the way you handle stress, the way you handle anger. Do you need to improve your attitude at work? And of course, as I said, other factors can profoundly affect one's career as well as one's personal life. So let's start with kind of the obvious things like physical health. Do you need to reduce or even eliminate your substance use? Do you need to increase, decrease, or otherwise change your exercise routine? That can make a big difference in your energy level and your overall health. Do you need to better treat a disease you have? Like if you have diabetes, it can cause serious cognitive function loss if you don't manage it well. Do you need to lose weight, which will help you gain energy? And certainly that list would not be complete if I didn't say, should you be stopping smoking? Now I want to turn to emotional health, because of course your emotional health can affect your career. Do you need to get counseling for a mental health issue? Do you need to try or change medication for a mental health issue? Do you need to try self-help approaches like journaling, which many people find really valuable because it's very empowering? You're not ceding your power to some counselor type, but it forces you to slow down and reflect. So journaling, the aforementioned exercise, which has been found to be one of the keys to, for example, ameliorating depression. What I call thought replacement, which is simply every time there's a worrisome thought that comes into your head, you replace it with a productive one. Force yourself. Doesn't always work, but it's certainly a low-risk activity. Or co-coaching with a friend or a support group. Those are some questions to consider in terms of you're burned out and your career is suffering, but perhaps a root cause or a root step forward lie in fixing some aspects of your emotional health. Now I want to turn to relationships. This is one of the things that has surprised me most in my 30 years as a career counselor. How often one's relationships or lack thereof has a spillover effect on one's work life. So I'm going to ask you some questions to consider if your burnout is caused in part from a relationship factor and perhaps spilling over into your career. Do you need to find a new romantic relationship? We've all seen people in the throes of a good relationship and perhaps shunning off or throwing away a bad one who suddenly feel more capable of doing everything, including in the workplace. Do you need to improve an existing romantic relationship? Maybe by focusing on clearer communication, better listening, or limit setting. You know, maybe taking one issue at a time and setting some limits on what you'll accept in yourself or in your partner? Do you need to do that by yourself, with a counselor, with a friend or relative? Do you need to end, as I mentioned briefly in the context of another question, do you need to end an existing romantic relationship? So many people are in romantic relationships that are draining, where you feel you can't even face work because you're so exhausted from the relationship that's bad. Do you need to improve an existing platonic relationship? It could be with a friend or a family member. Maybe, you know, sometimes you're having this fight with your longtime best friend, and it's affecting you even in the workplace. Do you need to end a friendship? You know, sometimes there are so many people who in friendships are so taking. They're endlessly complaining, or they're endlessly wanting your time. And at some point you feel it's just too much, and it's affecting your personal life and your work life. So might you want to end that relationship? Do you want to improve your relationship with your child or parent? How many parents come to work exhausted because they can't get their kid to behave, or they're fighting with their spouse about the right way to parent, more laissez-faire or more limit setting? Or your kid has got a drug problem, or is doing badly in school, has bad friends. That can be exhausting. Do you need to really focus on that, either again by yourself or with a professional? And next, even one's recreational and creative life can affect one's ability to do one's work. I have many people who may have a mundane job, but they love, for example, they're going to go play softball after work, or, you know, they are going to get together with friends or whatever it is. Do you need to do more of one of your current recreational or creative activities? Do you need to find a new recreational or creative activity, or resurrect one you've done previously? So many people find, I mean, I love the Wallace Stegner story. The guy was selling insurance, and at night he was a novelist, a writer. And of course he became very famous as a result. But you can be sure that whatever feeling of is that all there is from being an insurance salesman was mitigated by the fact that he would come home and write. And finally, a sense of purpose can be critical to avoiding burnout. Do you spend sufficient time, and perhaps money, on what you most believe in, whether it be your kids or a cause or your career? We tend to devalue the standard, you know, for-profit careers, but I've had many clients who find great pleasure in having a role in with a company that makes a product that is worthy. And another kind of a subset of sense of purpose, do you want to increase or decrease your spending on material things, products and or services? I've had many clients who try to avoid their sense of burnout or misery about their career and their life by trying to spend their way to contentment, and that is, just like a drug addict, upping his dose is not going to be the path toward ultimate contentment, merely temporary going blotto. So those are 23 questions that I like to think are in fuller dimension than what is often thought about when we talk about career burnout. Might one or more of those 23 questions suggest how you, or someone you care about, might start to lift yourself from the pit of burnout? Anyway, that's generic advice, but I'm always interested in helping you as individuals, because when you call in, I may be able to help you, I often am, but as important, the lessons from a concrete example are helpful to many other people who are listening. So, if you or someone you care about is feeling burned out, especially regarding one's career, which is the focus of this show, I invite you to call while the lines are available. The phone number here, I will certainly try to help you. I call them workovers with no pummeling involved, and the price is certainly right, zero. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco and KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And I thought to kind of prime the pump, the first person to call can, if they wish, get a free copy of my new book, Careers for Dummies. And all I'll ask you to do is, at the end of the show, which is 8 o'clock, to call back and leave your address, mailing address, and I will send you a copy of that book autographed for free. Again, the phone number, if you feel you or someone you care about feels burned out and you would like me to try to help you get unstuck, the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And to the phones, welcome to the show. It is your turn on the air. You are the first person, so certainly feel free at the end of the show to call back and leave your address, and I'll send you a copy of the book. So, how can I help you?
Hi, Marty. Thank you so much. Can you hear me?
My pleasure. I hear you perfectly.
Thank you. First of all, so I am 40 years old. I went to the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Mm-hmm. About $19,000 in debt with a bachelor's degree. After this, I sort of temped in Boston, mm-hmm. went ahead and temped for Salesforce on Market Street. Mm-hmm. Didn't really like the big corporation, got into solar power, listened to some of your shows about solar power. Mm-hmm. And then from 2007 until present, I'm in the cannabis industry. Mm-hmm. And it started off because I could use tools, I could build out rooms. I didn't trust it at that point, and then I started to evolve to see how it is now. And what my role has been since 2016 after a failed video career, because there's every videographer under the rock, mm-hmm, like you say, mm-hmm. is that I went ahead and found this entrepreneur. And they were this team of engineers, master's degrees, and they designed boxes, high-efficiency laboratories for the cannabis sector. I've been a retainer with them for about 2 years. They closed a big deal in Massachusetts, and I never saw a pay raise. There's no talk of negotiating the contract. I'm currently sort of feeling sort of burnt out on that. And I am in Massachusetts, which seems mm-hmm. to be a very promising market. And that's sort of where I'm at currently.
Okay. And it sounds like the you've made a number of mentions that imply that you'd like to stay in the cannabis industry. Am I correct in saying that?
I believe so. Correct. Yes. Okay. I'm okay with for-profit. Because I always want to give back. That's my goal someday.
Okay. Let's play diagnosis, though. You know, it could be the reason that in all that time you put in this very profitable industry, that they were simply greedy, let's say, bad people.
And, their business practices are questionable. I think as a group of people, they're okay.
Right. But do you believe that, was there anything in the, were you an insufficiently good employee that they say, you know, we don't need to pay this guy more to keep him, he's not that great, or really were they just jerks?
I always ask for follow-up and progress reports from the head of operations, and there was always positive feedback. There were CRM metrics to show. I had put meetings on, I had talked to venture capitalists, I had talked to growers, they basically paid me about $25 an hour as a 1099 to research every company out there and build a CRM system up mm-hmm. from scratch. Mm-hmm. And that was my role. You know, I had a solar power sales position, but I was in an office and that gave me anxiety. I was allowed to work at home, which allowed me space to think clearly and to be able to focus on the work.
Okay. And as you think about the ideal role for yourself moving forward in the industry, Is it in customer relationship management? Is it in sales? Is it in building out buildings, labs? Where, if there was a God, where would he say you were most likely to make an ethical contribution?
That's a very challenging question. I see a lot of potential income for this industry, and like I said, I want to give back. Eventually, and what's really sort of captivated me is how do people get into decision making with venture capital or investments? You know, does that feel like a finance degree in school? Is that something I could do? You know, so I could, shift in that direction.
Venture capital tends to be a closed system, consisting. I know. I remember that you said you went to UMass Amherst. There tends to be a barrier to entry in that field that says if you don't go to Harvard, Yale, Stanford, etc., you're considered probably not enough brain power for their tastes. So,
correct.
But there are certainly smaller investment entities under the general rubric of private equity or et cetera, that aren't quite as rigorous. So if you're interested more in the fundraising, which of course is sales, you know, sales, essentially, you might want to go that route.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
What's interesting, I think, some of your advice from people, you know, because I don't have any money, I don't have any equity. So I think it's interesting when you say that people need to move forward is to stay in the sales. So I think maybe possibly looking at another city, say Denver, the Bay Area is too expensive, where the recreational or medical cannabis is available, I could get a decent sales role. Maybe I could push $65,000-$70,000 and commit to 2 years, pay off my student loans, or invest in a rental. What's interesting when we talked about Harvard and the other business schools is that I clicked on an ad from Harvard, and I was chosen to kind of interview, and not chosen to talk about this certification program from Harvard. It's the pilot program was last year, and it's a 9-month program. And you know, the summary that I could grab from it was that it was based on a model of congruence, and this certification program would allow you to go and work within a company that has a great idea but doesn't have the manpower to pull the startup off of it. That was the gist of it, right? So you have a full functioning company that produces a widget, and they're doing great, but they don't have the resources to start a subdivision of this company where they have a great idea. This is what this Harvard Business School program was talking about.
So my number of reactions, I always get myself a little nervous when I start to get pessimistic. When I spoke about the venture capitalists, preferring Harvard degrees, you know, Harvard knows that their brand name is invaluable, and they use it as a cash cow by offering a variety of these certificates so people can put on their resume, I went to Harvard, you know, I got a certificate. But when it comes down to actual employment, you know, the employers sophisticated enough to be venture capitalists are sophisticated enough to know there's a Grand Canyon of difference in the admission standards for a certificate program and getting going to Harvard undergraduate. So, you know, and those tend to be inordinately expensive, either because they know it's the cash cow, or there are certain people who are working for companies and they know that the companies have enough deep enough pocket, they'll pay Harvard's prices. So I'm not necessarily convinced, and especially given your background, where you were a temp, you know, at Salesforce, and then you're selling solar, and then you were building cannabis labs, and now you know, you were creating a customer relation management software. You know, it's not like you tack on some certificate from Harvard and suddenly some big consultant, Accenture, is going to say, oh, good, come here, we'll pay you $200,000 a year.
Right.
So I'm not sold on that particularly.
Right.
I would rather, you know, if you are salesy, I guess the big takeaway in this little call, you know, I love to go under the radar. Unless you're a superstar, have a superstar background, you know, it feels like the major cities, you know, when I think of pot, I do think of Colorado and I do think of California. But there are a number of states that are have legalized it or are in the process that are more under the radar. And I'm given that you're open to geographic movement, I'm wondering
Somewhat. I'm an average sales rep, just to sort of intervene. I'm not an exceptional, but I'm decent. But I'm very biased towards the Liberal Coast, I'll be honest. I've spent the last 10 years on and off in the Bay Area of Oakland, San Francisco, in your area, where my college friends started. That's how I, in my mindset, I was like, well, I have these close friends, I can work my network out from the Bay Area. It's an interesting factor.
Well, then what I would probably do, if you've got a solid network, and you would like to stay in what you call the left coast, I would invite you to make a list of 10 people whom are the 10 human beings most likely to, not necessarily hire you, but to know somebody who they could open a door for. And then, you know, it could end up being in the cannabis industry or something else. But most likely, you know, when you have a varied background, it's mostly, if you just answer ads, you're pretty much dead. Because if an employer is going to hire somebody based on an ad, he's going to hire somebody who's got, you know, a series of progressive employment promotions over the last 10 years. And you've kind of jumped around. So your best shot would be to contact your 10 people who know people, and, you know, if you're interested in the cannabis industry, and tell them, look, I've got this kind of skill set. I'm a B salesman. I am nonetheless, I've got some skills in being able to use Salesforce and customer resource management, developing software, you know, behind the back office work. And I know something about the cannabis industry. I built labs. And with that kind of broad skill set, might you know somebody that I should speak with?
Great. I love it. That's solved a lot of information. I'm going to quote really quick. I'm sure you have other callers about the materialism thing where it doesn't bring any happiness. I'm 40 years old. I grew up very, very poor, very blue collar. And one of the things I'd love to see in the United States is a trend of reusing things. You know, I have a very old mountain bike, a very old snowboard, but they're functional. And I take pride.
I understand.
Great.
You know what I enjoy? I enjoy that people now increasing, it's like the norm, that people simply put out on the street stuff they don't need, and that it's a no-friction, no-bureaucracy way in which people reuse. I really love that.
Absolutely. I did that in Oakland. I found it fascinating. It was the first place I ever did that. And I was like, oh, this is fantastic.
Now, before you love me too much, I do need to say, Time Magazine hired me to do a review of the literature on the actual effects of marijuana, notwithstanding what the advocates would have us believe.
Sure.
And I would ask you to, in 2000, so either read my article, which reviewed the literature, or if you don't want to just trust me, because who the hell am I? I'm just Marty Nemko. But the National Academy of Sciences did a meta-analysis of the 200 best studies on the impacts of marijuana, and talk about the decrease of IQ, the increase in schizophrenia, increase in depression, increase in social anxiety, and cardiovascular and cancer risks. So it's not sure. I mean, you know, everybody's, you know, we tend to feel like we're cool when we celebrate marijuana legalization. But I would invite you, at the risk of you hating me, to, you know, you talked about giving back. Three times you mentioned giving back in our conversation. I'm wondering whether being in the cannabis industry is the best way to think about giving back. And I don't want an answer. I just ask you to consider that, and I hope you don't hate me for asking.
No, I agree with that. I think it should be in the same category as alcohol issues or cocaine issues or food issues, and it should be used in moderation. That should always be a disclaimer with everyone. I don't see that a lot.
Complex question beyond the area of career, so I won't go there.
Love it.
Moderation, some people can moderate, some people can't, and there's real question about which is more dangerous. Way beyond the scope of this show, I'm told to keep on the career issue. So there you go. I do wish you the best of luck, though. Do give back. It's a good thing to do, I swear.
Thank you so much, Marty.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye. All right. If you've got, if you are burned out or otherwise have any kind of a career question or a career problem, that's what my mission here is to do. This is my pro bono work. I get paid quite well during the week to be a career counselor. But here I do it for you, for anybody, whether you're rich or poor, 16 or 76, for-profit or nonprofit. The one thing you can count on is I will give you my best, and I've been doing it for 30 years on this show. I've heard a lot. So if you've got a work-related problem, you're burned out, somebody else is, and you would like some career help of any sort, feel free to call. The phone number here is at Work with Marty Nemko, KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And I should say, in addition to your questions, I love when people tell stories. Maybe something great happened to you this week at work, or something terrible, or you've got a business idea. You know, people say that, you know, one person told me recently that, you know, you're like a Shark Tank, except a little kinder. So if you've got a business idea you want to run by me, I will ask you some questions and give you my best thoughts on, A, its viability and what I would do to try to improve it. The phone number, again, here at Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And back to the phones. Welcome to the show. It is your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hi, Marty. How are you?
I am well. What gives me the honor of the call?
Well, this show is actually quite funny timing for me because I just got off work and I was just thinking about quitting because of how exhausted I am. And I have a plan about what to do next, but I'd like some clarity, and so let me give you background.
Great.
I'm a certified educator who has a master's degree, lives in the Bay Area, so of course very expensive and very hard to obviously survive here. But about a year ago, I took a new job working for a private family to teach their children in the home. So I guess the technical term would be governess.
Yep.
because I'm also doing some nannying as well.
Uh-huh.
And when I signed up, we agreed to terms of my employment, and they pay me really well. But throughout the year, those terms have slowly drifted away from what we originally agreed on.
What kind of terms are you referring to?
So hours, responsibilities, mainly. So
Have they increased your hours and responsibility, or decreased them?
They have increased them, and they've altered them to fit their changes in their family op, which is uh-huh. understandable, but it was never formally addressed, and now it's gotten to the point where I can't. I've lost the social life because I'm working nights and mornings, and the only time I have off is when all my friends are working.
I see.
So, one of the reasons I took the job was to spend some time to earn my administrative credential, and mm-hmm. I'm one exam away from earning that credential.
Right.
The exam will be in February, so I still have some time. But what I'm wondering is, having already spoke to them about requesting that if they want me to start working at 6:30 in the morning, I need to leave by 6 p.m. the
sure.
night before.
Wow.
Which isn't happening, and so I'm losing sleep. I'm gaining
wow.
weight.
Oh boy!
It's becoming.
Yeah.
Really, really difficult.
Yep.
So,
yep.
I'm wondering if, like, how to smoothly leave, mm-hmm. In a way that doesn't seem so personal, but also, like, I'm wondering how much is enough time, because I know childcare is so difficult to find in the Bay mm-hmm. Area. And then also, like, ideally, I would like to have passed the exam and have a job lined up before I quit, so
right.
that I know that I can tell them there's a great reason. But,
right.
Anyway. I'll let you respond.
To what extent, you know, it sounds like if somebody, there are some people who don't have much of a personal life and wouldn't mind working long hours in exchange for the good pay, and it's a relatively cushy job. I'm sure they're wealthy, and so you're not living in a horrible place. So
right.
I'm wondering if you could come up with one of your friends or relatives who would love a job like that, they would be less put out, because they've got a replacement. There isn't this gap that they have to deal with. Might there be anybody you know who might like this job?
There is one person. I actually, all my family lives on the East Coast,
mm-hmm.
and all my friends are in other industries.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's so funny you say that, because recently this girl I used to nanny for, like, when I was in high school,
mm-hmm.
she reached out to me and asked me about my job, and she's maybe a college freshman now, but she's interested in now becoming a nanny, which is so funny. But I suggested that she finish school first, because
yeah,
it would
be kind of dead end. It would kill if she wants to go to college, unless she's looking for an excuse to not go to college. A lot of people who end up going hating it. But if she's
yeah.
is she planning to stay in college and wants to do that?
I think she is not loving her college. She's a commuter student, and she's just not enjoying her experience. However, a lot of the families that I've met require a bachelor's degree, and I know there are other training programs for nannies, like there are schools for nannies and stuff. But I don't know much about them, and
right.
so. If I could put her on the right path, then she could totally replace me.
Sounds like a long shot, though. It sounds like it may not be in her best interest right now. She's not ready
right.
to quit. And,
right.
you know, she's not experienced, and then you're taking a little bit of risk just because you know this one person. She may not be that awesome. So, it sounds anti-intellectual, but for me, I'd use the following word. I would start... looking for a job, you want to be an education administrator in a school or a school district or a county or the state, I would start my search now and explain in your applications that your administrative credential is pending an exam next month. And not quit, but when it did come time to quit, what I'd probably say is something like this. I always start with the good things. It's been a pleasure, indeed an honor, to work for you. I really enjoy your kids, I enjoy this, I enjoy that, I appreciate the pay, etc. it is time now. I'm very fortunate that I'm able to move on with my career. I've just completed my administrative credential, or I'm completing it, and hope to get a job as a school administrator. And I just wanted to give you as much notice as possible. Let's work together to see about, I can be flexible as to my end date so that you're not left hanging. What do you think? What do you think about that kind of wording?
That sounds fantastic. I think that keeps it professional. It really shows how grateful I am for them fully employing me for the time that they have. I think that I need to write it down because it couldn't have said it better.
Awesome. Do you want me to? I'll try to say. You want me to say it again?
No, that's okay.
You're good? Okay, I'm just trying to serve.
Yeah,
okay, thank you then very much. I'm glad I was of help. Thanks for calling Work with Marty Nemco.
Good night.
Yeah, good night. We got plenty of calls. Let's go right back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hi, Marty. This is Michelle.
Hi, Michelle.
And, so I'm 49 years old, mm-hmm. and I've been in my career for more than 20 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And, I really love what I do. I feel like I made the right career choice.
Mm.
But I'm kind of deep into it right now, and I have two children. I have, my son's going to be starting college in a few years. And I feel like I just want to know what ways you kind of can give me to keep going, because I'm not necessarily ready to change jobs. I have a great commute. I work for a company that treats me pretty well. Not totally great, but pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just feeling like when I go to work, I don't get the time to do what I love, because I'm now that I have the years in, you're expected to do management, which I'm not really good at. I don't necessarily love, but I have to do if I want the money. And so I'm a creative person. That's my job. I love the creative part, but I really have to play the role of manager.
Okay.
So it's tough to kind of keep going with that.
So multiple choice. Here's a buffet. Which one or more of these feels like it might be of help? Number one, the most obvious, cut back to 3 or 4 days a week. Two, take less money and say, you know what? We all need to know where our strengths are. I'm an individual contributor. I love the creative work, but I'm not so great at the management, and letting them know that. And maybe even by cutting back to 4 or 3 days a week, giving up some of the money, but making those 3 or 4 days a week that which, is going to be doing the creative. That can help. Two would be to try to work on your management skills, either by getting one-on-one mentorship from somebody in your workplace, by taking an online course, by watching some YouTube videos, by reading articles. And number three would be to just improve the quality time you have with your kids, because it sounds like your kids are really important to you. And whenever somebody tells me they got their kids going to college a couple of years, and they mention that in the context of a career call, it suggests to me that they really care a lot about wanting to bring as much pleasure and contact time with their kids before they go to college. So which of those feels like it might help?
Really, all of them. Those are great. I mean, it's super true. Like, if I could quit tomorrow, I would, but I can't,
mm-hmm.
because I do, I need to live in the Bay Area.
Right.
But you're right. I need to spend as much time with them as possible.
Quality time.
Quality. Yeah, and I also need to take those management courses so that it's easier for me, and that takes that part of the day that's hard for me,
right,
and makes it more enjoyable.
Now, courses very often are ineffective at improving management skills, much more effective. That's why the first thing I mentioned was, is there a really good manager there who could mentor you? Who you could tell your, I'm having problems with John because John is blah, 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 blah. What should I do? Or, I'm managing, but I can't keep track of all the spreadsheets. Or is there somebody either in your workplace or even outside who you could work with one-on-one to help you with your management skills?
I'll have to see if I can find that person. That's actually a really good point.
Let's play here on the radio for a moment. Let's tell me about one either really sticky, annoying part of the management that you would like my help with, because this is what I do for a living, so you're getting it for free.
Okay, so say, for instance, I have someone who comes in with the expectation that they've got a lot of experience and they're very knowledgeable,
mm-hmm.
and you find, and they've got a good portfolio, and then you find this when they start working that something's quite a little bit missing, maybe a little bit misrepresented,
mm-hmm.
and I have really high expectations. If someone says they can do it, I want them to own it.
Okay.
So I have a hard time being tough on people because I like to give people a long leeway to succeed, mm-hmm. and I like to have them, because I like to work independently, so I try to let other people.
You're not being flexible. The good manager does not have one size fits all. If the good manager were to decide, you know what, I can or cannot get rid of this person. The really good managers say, if this person is too weak, they get rid of them. They just do, you know, and they try to counsel them out. Because if you fire them, they file lawsuits and stuff these days. The world has changed. People don't leave with their tail between their legs anymore. They blame you. So normally what you try to do is, if you really think they're irretrievable or it's going to take too much time to retrieve them, you even talked about their being dishonest in terms of how much skill they proclaim to have, mm-hmm. then you decide to counsel them out, take them out to coffee, tell them, you know, there's a little bit of a mismatch. You want to let them save face. You know, there's kind of a mismatch between the skill set required for this job and the work that's being done here. Here, for example, look at this kind of work that looks really good, and here are some examples that you're doing that's quite a bit different. Do you think you might be better if I help you find a job that's more in keeping with your skill set? So counseling them out so they don't feel this antipathy is one option. And if you feel you can't get rid of them or don't want to get rid of them, then you don't want to devote too much time in your weak employees, because then you're not spending enough time doing what you do well. So what you want to do is either find somebody else to mentor or coach them, to tell them that they've got to improve, again, in a face-saving way, but saying, here's how you might want to take this online course or learn this software or whatever. Which of those, if any, feels like an appropriate approach to this one weak worker?
I think the counseling out, you know, really communicating, because, you know, I definitely have a problem with really sort of communicating what I need and feel at that time. And, you know, it's been a while since I've managed people, so I agree. I need those skills.
And if you say you have a hard time communicating it before you get to the counsel out, sometimes, let's say you know this person, sometimes it helps to, in your journal or simply in a word processing program, to pretend to script out what you would say to him or her, so as it would be face-saving, yet providing the appropriate feedback that would be motivating for that person to try to improve or to counsel them out. Should you be kind of, not that you would memorize a script because it's going to sound ridiculous, but as a kind of a way to prepare for that meeting, should you be writing out what you might say to that person?
Yeah, that's a great idea. And, you know, I've had some seriously great mentors in my career, mm-hmm. and they're the ones that I've really learned from, and right. I've always wanted to be that to other people.
Right.
But people have to also want it, too.
That's correct.
And so when they're not listening, it's tough, you know.
That's
so
correct.
I can't get in their face. If they want it, they want it. If they don't.
Right. In the face doesn't win. This, in 1950, in your face works. In the year 2019, in your face doesn't work.
Right.
There is a real de-emphasis on hierarchy, command and control. It's all about collaboration, teamwork,
absolutely.
Acceptance, all the rest of that. And therefore, one must have a 2019 approach to management, which is either you try to you realize they're irretrievable, in which case you first try to gently counsel them out, and if that doesn't work, you've got to follow the legal procedures for termination, or you spend a small amount of time on that remediation. Like I said, you can't give them too much time, but a little bit of time in coaching, maybe showing a few models, sending them home with some homework to say, how can you do something? Can you work on trying to get to this level? Suggesting a course so that you're not spending a huge amount of time, but you are not in that very difficult situation. Because if the counseling out fails and you've got to get rid of them, you are dealing with stress maximus in general in the year 2019, especially in the Bay Area, where employees really get, I don't think I can say the word, but just really angry at getting let go.
Right.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your help.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much for calling Work with Marty Nemko.
Okay, have a good night.
You too. All right, I'm going to take one more call, then I got another other stuff I want to talk to you about. I had an interesting client today, before I left here, who left my office to come here, who is a very typical client of mine. You know, he's got a bachelor's degree, liberal arts-ish, not from a Harvard or Stanford, but from a second-tier school, and doesn't know what he wants to do. He doesn't have any great passion. So I want to talk to you about the ways in which somebody who's got a bachelor's in a software, he's not an artificial intelligence guy, what are the ways that, and preparing for the show, I thought through the roughly, you know, I've had, you know, what was it now, 5,500 clients. You know, what are my typical clients in that situation end up doing? But I want to go to the phones just one more time before I do that. So, welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. I'll give out the phone. Nah, let me just go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you? Hello, it's your turn.
Hi, my name's David.
Hello, David.
Hi, and I'm one of your regular listeners.
Thank you.
I would get a lot from this.
Good.
It's about your thought about street music in San Francisco.
Right.
I have this word.
Let's let our listeners know. Last week, a woman called in and said, why can't San Francisco have a culture that's more like New Orleans, where street music, you know, was more a part of the culture, given that, you know, there's a hell of a lot of good musicians who can't begin to make a living, and it might be a way to just improve the overall tenor of San Francisco instead of being, these days we think of San Francisco, we think of homeless, and this way it would create a more festive atmosphere in San Francisco. Is that a fair summary?
Right. Okay, and I'm right on your path. And in the meanwhile, in the interval, I looked it up, and the only restriction on street music is your noise level.
Right.
You don't have to have a separate permit. You just have to stay within the decibel noise level ordinance.
Right.
And then you could play, you could sing, you could say your poem.
Right.
And it's all okay. It's copacetic.
The previous call, the caller last week, though, was saying, hey, I want these musicians who are so great, it's so sad they can't even begin to pay back their student loans, let alone make a living. So the conversation was about getting the city of San Francisco and its tourism bureau or whatever to fund some of these musicians. Free, yes, we know that you can just, you know, as long as you're not loud. By the way, at my Rockridge BART station, there is this unbelievably bad saxophone player who plays, it's got to be beyond any decibel. I would pay him to stop playing, but I digress. Anyway, thanks a lot for calling Work with Marty Nemco.
You're hilarious.
I try.
Right, thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye. Okay, so I'm not going to take any more calls for a little while here. Like I said, I want to talk a little bit. And we'll go to the phones in a few minutes, but I wanted to share with you, like I said, just the client right before I left my home office in Oakland to come here, I had a very typical client, bachelor's degree in a liberal art from a second-tier college, doesn't have any undying career passion. It's not like he wants to, you know, do solar or save the whale or whatever. He's, you know, kind of interested in a lot of things, but not really passionate about much of anything. So I'm going to spare any of the details because I want to make sure I preserve his anonymity. I'm going to talk about not so much some dreamy, idealistic thing, but what, as I said, in preparing for coming here today, I thought through all of my clients and I said, what do people like that actually end up doing? And how do they do it? And the most important thing they do is they leverage family and friend connections. See, because they're too typical. It's not like they have some huge, great skill set. If they majored in sociology and they graduated from San Francisco State, you know, that's going to make most employers yawn, you know. So typically these people, they end up exploring some career options but conclude that no one is sufficiently appealing to justify turning down a what I call a career launching job that dropped in their lap, like a parent gets their kid an interview at their own workplace or offers them a job in the family business or their girlfriend's mother gets them a job, because they're just not that passionate or anything. And so when I look at all my clients, that's a very common thing they do. And these people end up deciding simply that the job is going to be as good or better than what they could come up with on their own, where they're having to apply for a job by answering an ad, which ends up meaning they get crappy jobs like working at the Enterprise Rent-A-Car at nights and weekends. And so they're really right. You know, while it's true that a small percentage of people have only one career that is quintessentially right for them, you know, computer game designer, ballet dancer, whatever, most people's career success will depend more on job attributes that exist across many careers, whether the work is moderately challenging, whether the boss is good, whether the commute is reasonable, whether the pay is decent, whether it's not some little temp gig where you're going to be back looking for work again in another month. And jobs like that disproportionately go to people with an in. And that's especially, as I said, true of new grads with a bachelor's of, you know, in something like psychology or gender studies or whatever, dance theory. So that's the most common thing, way that those bachelor's degree holders in soft fields from a second-tier school end up getting a job. And so they've got to be, and the message to you, dear listeners, is if that's you or someone you love, you've got to leverage those family and friend connections, and that means being focused. It means, first of all, not being embarrassed to tell your family and friends you're looking for a job. And it means not just telling your parents, but making a list of 10, 20, as many as you can stomach, people who like you, family, friends, girlfriend's friends, whatever, and tell them, don't say I'm open to anything, I'm desperate, but giving them just a little bit of guidance as to the kind of things you do well. So if you're more of a word person, you tell them that you're good at writing and speaking. If you're more of a salesy type, tell them that. If you're of nonprofit values, tell them that. So you don't need to be micro-specific and say, I want to be an entomologist who's focusing on species degradation in the Amazon. But you want to focus on, you want to give them something that is specific enough so that they don't think you're desperate and say, I'm open to anything. Okay. I also have, you know, as I think about all my clients that have this kind of bachelor's from a in some social science or humanity from a second-tier school, what some of them also do is they do consider what I call under-the-radar careers that I talk to them about. It's usually some amalgamation of their skills and interests, like grant writer, which they wouldn't have thought of, or child life specialist who helps ill kids and who are chronically ill kids who spend a lot of time in the hospital to get an education and some fun, or patent agent, which is helping people to get a patent, which you don't have to be a lawyer, by the way, to do that. I won't go through the details, but it's true. Other careers, and if I have time later, I'll talk about it. Let me see. I've got a list here of some of these that are kind of under the radar. A political writer. We're very political here in the Bay Area. Political campaign manager. Surveyor. They go and get a certificate program and say being an electro-neurodiagnostic technician. They used to call them EEG technicians. They try to be one of these coaching things, especially if they're young, for, you know, dating coaches or parenting coaches, or if they're older, retirement coaches. So these are kind of under the radar careers that a lot of these bachelor's degree holders choose. I have more of these directions that bachelor holders from second tier schools in social sciences and humanities go, but I want to give out the phone number now. So if you, especially if you or someone you care about has a bachelor's degree in not computer science, not applied mathematics, not physics, but psychology, sociology, women's studies, African American studies, dance, critical theory, any of those kind of things, and are therefore having a hard time finding employment that allows you to live in the Bay Area. The phone number here, work with, or art, or music, journalism. It's unfortunately a path to underemployment. If you or someone you care about is a graduate, one of those majors, and is having trouble, some of you, you know, with people with those backgrounds make a good living, of course. But if you are having some difficulty or someone you care about is having such difficulty, I invite you to call and I will try to provide customized advice for you. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko. This is my pro bono work. I get paid reasonably during the week for doing this, but I do this for you here at KELW for free. The phone number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Of course, there are many of these bachelor's degree holders who, after not finding a job for a while, they say, I really don't want more school. But they've tried for a while, but they choose to spend the money, bite the bullet, and spend the time and money on grad school. They go to law school. They could try to get an MBA or a master's in public policy is really popular here, public health. All these public, these non-profit-y things, non-profit management, they choose, again, some less top-of-mind field, like landscape architecture or optometry if they're science-y. They like that grad school offers a structured path that at least ostensibly increases the hireability. Also, grad school is a socially acceptable way to avoid looking for a job. You know, and it's kind of fun. When you're a student, you don't think about it at the time. I didn't think about it when I was in school. But when you're a student, you're spending most of your time taking, that is being taught, learning stuff, more time taking than producing. You know, yeah, you're writing papers and studying for tests, but that's less. Where in the workplace, you're mainly having to produce. And so a lot of people like going to graduate school because it's socially acceptable, you're on the taking end, and you aren't getting a good paying job anyway, so it provides that important attribute, hope. So many people do that. Some people who have these bachelor's degrees in humanities and social science from second-tier schools, they don't pick a career, but they scan job sites such as Indeed.com or Craigslist.com or LinkedIn.com, and they apply to just any job that feels okay, something that generally matches their broad core strengths, that is, like I said, words or people or numbers, and generally that works only when the client is really willing to apply to lots of jobs and to customize their resume and cover letter for each. It's a lot of work. And the reason that requires all that is because, as I said earlier, new bachelor's degree holders rarely have enough successful, marketable experience to make their application number one among the dozens or hundreds of applications that come in for most decent jobs that are openly advertised for entry-level professionals that don't require substantial technical expertise. So there are a lot of people like that. Then there are people who, frankly, as I think, again, I was making this list of, I thought back all my clients who were young and just starting out with those social science and humanity degrees from not Harvard or Stanford or Berkeley. A lot of them they continue to flounder. And then some of it is just, they just don't feel the urgency to find a career. I had a client who recently said, you know, I'm 24, but I don't feel like I'm ready to grow up. I like skateboarding. I like hanging out with my friends. I like getting high, he even said. And they don't feel guilty about that. They somehow feel it's okay for their parent or their romantic partner or the taxpayer to support them. Or some of these people are willing to live very, very modestly, so they have five roommates. And so they're okay, literally or figuratively, with being a barista, you know, the stereotype. And many of them, you know, when I think about that subset of people, many of them have artistic sensibilities, but they're not the kind who have this awesome talent or drive to beat the odds of making a living from their creative output. And some of these people, they feel that's just a stage and that, you know, I'll get serious later when I'm 28 or 30, you know, but others of them decide it is a good long-term choice to have a mundane job. You know, security guard, work in the art supply store, in the bookstore for minimum wage, or the barista job, so that they do have time to pursue their creative passion, whether it's writing or music or juggling or comedy or whatever it is. So now we get to the punchline. It's you. As you think about all these approaches that I've talked about, leveraging family and friend connections, or considering an under-the-radar career, or narrowing only slightly and applying for lots and lots of jobs through the front door, through LinkedIn and Indeed and Craigslist and whatever, or going to graduate school, or continuing to flounder, realizing you're just not ready to kind of be a grown-up yet, which would the wise one within you, the wise person within you, choose to take, you know, then as your goal for now, if you're one of those people or someone you care about has got that bachelor's degree and hasn't chosen a career yet? Anyway, I'll give out the phone number. If you or someone you care about has got a work-related problem of any sort, especially if, you know, if you're in that category of having a bachelor's degree, young or not so young, and are not sure what to do or how to go, where to go from here, and you're kind of dispirited, the phone number here, Work with Marty and Uncle, for what I call a workover with no pummeling involved usually, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And I just looked up the clock. God, the hour is almost over. So all I'm going to do is, because I had mentioned a couple of these careers that are a little under the radar before, I think I'll flesh a couple of them out. I want to talk about proposal writer, which I have talked about before, but I've had a number of people who listen to the show say it's the kind of thing they really like, because so many listeners to KELW have nonprofit values. Every year, federal and state governments issue thousands of what they call RFPs, requests for proposal, for every imaginable product or service. They may request, for example, proposals for a state-of-the-art data management system, or 300 desks for IRS offices, or 50,000 Navy uniforms. And there are corporate and private foundations that issue thousands more RFPs, requests for proposal. And to maximize the chance of receiving a grant, organizations hire proposal writers to search databases of RFPs, requests for proposals, to find the ones that that organization might qualify for. The proposal writer then talks to in-house staff, reviews the relevant literature, maybe consults with outside experts, and then crafts the proposal. It's a great career. It's endlessly innovative and creative. And not surprisingly, writers can be hired to both write those requests for proposals as well as to respond to them, that is, to write the grant proposals. And there is a Google, if you're interested in that, Google the Grantsmanship Center, you'll find it, and an excellent book called Proposal Writing, Effective Grantsmanship for Funding by something, I don't remember who wrote it. But anyway, so that's a great career. Here's another one that's under the radar. As I said, so many people in the Bay Area is a very political place, especially these days. And most politicians, from the town council person to the president, need writers. I have so many clients who would like to make their living in writing. This is one of the more viable ones, if you're good, of course. Political writers craft copies for the politician's website. They will craft copy for fundraising letters, for speeches, and for newsletters that, you know, I get that from Barbara Lee all the time. See how much I'm doing for you? Barbara doesn't write those newsletters. She's got writers to write that. One approach to landing such a job is to write a fundraising letter for your favorite local politician and send it as a sample. Because remember, unfortunately, money is the lifeblood not only of companies, but of nonprofits and certainly politicians, alas, although I really wish we had campaign finance reform, but that's off topic. So anyway, of course, that kind of work, political writing, the pinnacle of that is being a speechwriter. You have to probably have to start as a volunteer to do some basic writing for that favorite local elected official. But I found interesting, there was an article in the New York Times that Al Gore's speechwriter wrote on the speechwriter's life. So just Google New York Times Al Gore's speechwriter's life and you'll find it. I've got time for one more. Also in the political realm, political campaign manager, everyone who runs for office, from park board member, to President of the United States, needs one or more campaign managers. And people in that career use data analytics to understand voter opinions and to identify the supporters, the opponents, the undecideds. And increasingly, that's done all the way down to their single neighborhood block. So there's really, it's quite an esoteric process. Campaign managers also use that data to develop the candidate's themes and direct fundraising, allocates resources, coordinates the website, the social media, the email strategy, the snail mail strategy. They hire staff. They train phone bank workers. They coordinate door-to-door campaigns. They entice the media. They lead damage control. They even design the campaign button, the bumper sticker, the lawn sign. So it's very exciting because you're in charge of a winner-take-all contest that can maybe make a difference in society. So you may have to start as a volunteer, but it can be really pretty cool. And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me next Thursday. I'm going to talk about not only can you call in for a workover, but how to start and succeed in private practice. Until then, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.